Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you, and welcome to another episode of Frankly Speaking. This episode with Dana Lawn, the Managing Director of the Center for Advanced Turf Technology at the Toro Company. And Dana and I will start our conversation in a little bit. And I just want to give you a little bit of backdrop about what we're going to be talking about today. One of the things that's absolutely fascinating about interacting with professional engineers like Dana Lawn is the different perspective they bring to, certainly different than my perspective that I bring as a biologist, approaching a lot of the issues that we face in turf systems. All types of turf systems, golf, sports, lawn turf systems, and where technology and engineering can be of help today, next week, next month, next year, next decade, next 20 or 30 years. And those kinds of far-reaching looks are what's so important, and I think important every once in a while, to talk to the folks that are thinking about these sorts of things to see how we can begin as an industry to create a space for this technology, number one, to come in and work with us, and also to see how that technology, by moving towards it, might enhance efficiencies, might enhance economic gains, and of course might also improve environmental stewardship in the many different ways, particularly when you talk about watering and sensing technology. And so as we start our conversation with Dana Lawn, the Managing Director, Center for Advanced Turfgrass Technology, Dana, I'll welcome you to the program. Thank you for taking the time to do it. And one of the things I'll just remind everybody before we hear from you is I learned recently in seeing you at the Metropolitan Golf Association's Greens Chairman Seminar held earlier in the month that you're a lifelong Minnesotan and with Toro since the 1974. And just to make you feel even better about that, Dana, I was mowing grass as a 12-year-old in the New York metropolitan area when you started with the Toro Company. So why don't you take a minute, Dana, and give us a little bit about your background. I know you're a Minnesota guy. And talk about your 40-some-odd years with the Toro Company before we get going. Welcome to the program, Dana. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dr. Rossi. Enjoy the opportunity to talk to folks about this. Yeah, I actually started with Toro in 1969, right when I got out of high school. And I actually worked for the company photographer a while when I was going to college. So it's been my whole career. I've only had I worked for the Minneapolis Park Board for one summer. That's the only other paid job I've ever had in my life. So
and in fact, hardly have ever left the state of Minnesota because your degree is from the University of Minnesota, isn't it?
It is from the University of Minnesota. I have a bachelor's and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Minnesota, and I actually am the last engineering class of the slide rule.
That's so, right, I remember. But I heard you, and you passed the joke the other day that said you have a slide rule app on your phone.
I do have a slide rule app on my phone.
That is so great.
And I actually see that as very much an asset in my career because, one of the things that that have forced us to do, now it's really hard because now there's so much embedded in computers and software. It's so easy to just punch the numbers in and you get the answer back. And you don't really test against this. Does this make sense to the way that I understand the world? When I went to school, when I learned engineering, it was all about how do I make the problem simple enough that I can solve it with Stone Age tools.
Well, now we must seem to complicate things more.
And, Exactly. And there's a lot of times that people will get an answer back from the computers or the calculators, and it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
And there's times you just have to come back and say, you know, because there's some fundamental rules. It's like there's fundamental rules of science that are involved. There's conservation of energy. There's conservation of momentum. There's Newton's laws of motion. You have similar rule, and those rules apply to biology as well as they apply to devices and machines.
That's cool.
You know, the plants conserve energy just like everything else does. They take energy in and they convert it to other forms. And so the same basic rules apply.
And so your experience
the better that you can step back and say, well, how does the way I understand the rules of the world, how does that help me better interpret what's going on? I think that can be helpful, and to me that's helpful in the creation process.
Well, and seeing as you brought up seeing as you brought up the creation process as a product engineer and computer aided design and advanced engineering stuff you've been doing with Toro, I read you have 10 patents. So obviously that slide rule has served you well in forms of innovation.
It is. It does help, but you know, I would say the thing that I always say that to me the fuel of innovation is to speak to the end customer, and it's to understand the way the customer does their job. Because the challenge for us, for me, is how do I, you know, what does an engineer do? An engineer solves problems, and the better that we can understand what those problems are, the better chance you have of solving those in a creative way.
And I gotta tell you, what that sounds like is something I actually wanted to get to chatting with you about. I recall very well what you just said and how I heard similar words come out of the mouth of Doc Watson. And I know that you and Doc worked together for a really long time, and his legacy is there. And is this connection between the advanced technology and the customer very much related to the way Doc sort of interacted with people in his years with Toro?
I would say yes. No doubt about it. You know, Jim Watson is one of those guys that I would, I feel incredibly blessed to have known him and considered him a friend.
Right.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, he didn't, he never really sat down and taught me anything, but just the way he approached problems, I observed and I learned a lot as a result of that. You know, he's just one of those guys that just being around was one of those valuable people, you know. So, and, you know, he is one of those, I've thought a fair about, you know, having worked for 45 years in this business, I've thought a fair about, well, what made my career? What, you know, people have asked me, what do you want to be remembered for? And I really don't care what I'm remembered for, but what I do care about, and because I think about my own thing, I could list say 10 or 20 people that I would consider to have been influential to me, and clearly Doc Watson would be one of those people that I would list as saying he was very important to forming my knowledge and my being. I hope I'm on somebody's list.
That's right. So, and you know
that I have had some impact, that they've learned something from me.
Well,
that's a valuable, and to me, that's an important, because that's ultimately, in my opinion, that's our legacy, is have others learned from us.
Right. And I'm fortunate to be, as an academic, exposed and immersed in that environment on a regular basis. And so I've been fortunate, I know as many of my academic colleagues, and you probably as well, have having interacted with students and seeing the light in their eye when you've said something or when you've connected with them in some way. And in some ways, going back to our discussion of, you called it fueling innovation, you know, I would say looking for that spark in someone's eyes that takes what you have and then builds on it. And I think one of the things I always remember about my years of interacting with Doc Watson on the USGA Research Committee was when I would, you know, in my early 30s, when I was convinced I knew everything. Right. I would say, well, you know, research from such and such, and, you know, it was like in the last 5 years. And then Doc would invariably pull out a paper from the 20s or from the 40s and say, you know, Frank, we sort of have studied this before, and it would be really good if you looked back at older, you know, research from, you know, more than 5 years ago. And I think that sort of understanding of whether it's the customer, understanding of history, to know where we've been, to see where we're going, really has got to be what you toil over every day, isn't it, Dana? I mean, aren't you really imagining what the future is going to hold by thinking about where we came from?
Exactly. And it's all about, and a lot of times it's a lot of inventions. The invention is not new. It's a new application to a problem. It's like, where, you know, Henry Ford didn't invent the assembly line. Henry Ford applied the principles that they were using to slaughter hogs in Chicago to make cars more efficient. You know, and so that they, you know, it's a matter of, can you find a nugget that you can take and say, what's the essence of the idea, and can I apply this in a new way? That doesn't mean there aren't new things invented all the time, but a lot of times there are things that are applied in new ways.
Right, and I think I remember hearing from you that if what Ford said is, if he listened to his customers, he'd have a faster horse.
Yeah, that's been attributed to him, whether it's true or not. But the point is, it's a matter of we can only ask for what the context is that we have. And if you think about before the car was around, transportation was about horse and buggy. It wasn't about cars. And so it would be it's a very plausible quote, even if it isn't a true hard quote, but it does make in my opinion, it makes a point.
That's right. And so listen, Dana, let's take a break. A message from our sponsors who support the efforts at TurfNet. And we'll come back, and I want to change our conversation to some more technical topics around energy and sensing technology, automation stuff. So we'll be right back with the Managing Director, Center for Advanced Turf Technology at the Toro Company. This is Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject. The only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
And welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi here on the TurfNet Radio Network, joined so graciously by the Managing Director for the Center for Advanced Turf Technology at the Toro Company, Dana Lahn. And we started our conversation, Dana, by really, I have to say, letting us probe around a little bit of history, a little bit about motivation, a little bit about the mindset one has to take when considering solving some of our biggest challenges. And you know, I would have to say that the thing that continues to resonate with me over the last decade that your path and my path has crossed, particularly has been around energy, climate change, global warming, anthropogenic anthropogenic sources of carbon dioxide, and really, you know, energy and fuels. One of the things I've learned from sitting near you when you're speaking is sort of the way engineers look at fuel and the challenges to sort of fueling what we know is a fairly energy intensive operation, mowing grass, and particularly from a consumption of fossil fuels, would be them diesel or regular fuels. Where tell me the nature of the energy issue as you see it as an engineer, and where our industry needs to be moving just for dealing with this particular issue.
Sure. You know, as you say, it's a really broad topic. You know, the challenge that we have is that, you know, it's, if you go through the numbers, it's something like it takes like 800 pounds of lead acid batteries to equal the energy in a gallon of gasoline. You know, and so that, you know, that's the problem that we're all solving. That's the reason we don't have electric powered cars, or we don't have, there is just so much energy in a gallon of fossil fuel. And, right. It's just so incredibly dense. And so, the challenge, the engineering challenge is how do we make those that happen, right?
Well, it seems like you got to work at this from two points. Let me narrow it down for you a little bit. Let's think about working it with two points. Number one is, I got to believe, and we've seen in the turf industry, the real advancement of electric technology, be them standalone mowers or hybrid mowers. So certainly, number one, we're seeing potentially more efficient, or at the end of how we use the energy, one would hope much more efficiency, much less loss. And then you're working on the alternative energy perspective. You know, what can we use other than a gallon of gas? And while batteries or lithium batteries might be a interim technology, how long until you think we start to see, you know, the kinds of changes that are going to be dramatic from a energy perspective?
And that's where I was going to go. So the first thing we've done is, you know, when fuel was a dollar a gallon, and you know, it's come a bit cheaper today. And nobody worried about carbon. You know, basically, we didn't worry very much about efficiency, because it just wasn't an issue. Because ultimately, it becomes an economic game, right? It's a matter of what's the cheapest way, and the cheapest way was to buy more fuel. Now, as the cost of consuming fuel increases, then it makes more sense to improve efficiencies. And we've seen the same thing happen in the automotive business, right? As the cost of fuel goes up, there's been more motivation to improve the fuel efficiency of vehicles, or when fuel wasn't available. And so what have we done? We've done a number of things to improve efficiencies. We have, used more efficient hydraulic components, and just shut fans off, you know, those kinds of things when you don't need them, because we've studied. So if you're going to improve the efficiency of something, how do you do it? You find out where all the energy goes, and then you work on the biggest problem first, and you work on the areas that you're just not using the fuel very efficiently. And we found recently, we've done a number of things. You take your car today, very few cars have a fan that runs all the time. And the reason they don't do that is because it takes a lot of power to run those fans.
Right.
Well, we're doing the same thing now on turf equipment, that we turn the fans off when we don't need them. And it turns out that there's 5 or 6 or sometimes as much as 10% of the fuel was going to run a fan to make sure that the machine is cool enough. But that only is a worry when it's really, really hot out. Most of the time it isn't that hot, and so you don't need it. And it's like your car. Your car, when you're driving, you don't need a fan because you're blowing the air past it.
Well, listen. Let's take the topic of mowing
things, and so we're doing that kind of stuff. And then you know, a big part of the motivation towards hybridization. There's two benefits that you gain from hybridization. One is that in general the electric motor technology is more efficient. It's really not very different than going between old Edison's incandescent light bulb and a compact fluorescent or an LED. You've gone from something that's 1 or 2% efficient to something that's 20% efficient. Well, you take a look at a hydraulic motor. A hydraulic motor is on the order of, a good one is about 70% efficient. What that means is that 30% of the energy is wasted. The electric motors, a good electric motor is in the 85% efficient range.
Whoa.
So you've gone from, if you got a 70% efficient pump and a 70% efficient motor, you multiply those two together, that means you got 49% efficient. That means you're throwing half the energy away. Where if you go to an 85% efficient pump or a generator and an 85% efficient motor, you got 85 times 85, which is somewhere
80%?
In the 70s.
So
somewhere in the high 70s. And, you know, so you've got way less of the energy that you're wasting. So that makes a big difference.
Before you move on waste, let me ask a question where maybe energy use, I don't want to say waste, but energy use is being consumed to protect the environment. How much of the environmental controls that engines are being required to have now? I know the bigger the mower, obviously the big grounds, the big wide area mowers must have some of that. Even latest tier stuff, is that energy consumptive as well to keep the stuff out of the environment?
Our experience is that it's pretty much energy neutral. It might even be a little bit of a bit more fuel efficient. So we certainly didn't get orders of magnitude worse. And again, I would relate it back to cars. You know, if you look at cars, are way better than they were 30 or 40 years ago, and they are more mileage efficient than they used to be. You know, so, and we've kind of gone through ebbs and flows over the years, but, when you first implemented me, you maybe were not as good, but then engineers figured out better ways to do it, and we've gotten better with time. So let me ask you.
I don't know if this is a futuristic question, but I'd like to sort of get your sense. This is in my head and the way I think about it. If I live in Idaho, where I can get 85 to 90% of my power potentially from a hydroelectric plant, a fairly benign renewable energy source. Would you recommend to a guy like me that I have an entire electric fleet, knowing how golf courses have to be managed and things like that? Would that particular dramatic move, knowing where your energy is coming from, embracing the energy efficiency of electronics, how would you respond to a customer that said, listen, I want to go all electric and I get all my electricity from hydro. Dana, is that a good way for me to go?
Well, you know, the challenge that we have today is that I'm not sure that we could produce a set of – it gets down – some of these machines just consume a bit more power than you can carry with you on with batteries.
Hmm.
So, you know, I don't know that it's and to be honest with you, it'd be tough to make a Groundsmaster, you know, or a big rough rotary that was right. batteries, that we could just carry enough energy with us.
Because of the weight and the force that you've got to move the blades, right?
Yep, it just takes too much power to do it. You know, so it's a bit like an airplane. You know, an airplane's you got so much density and jet fuel.
Yeah.
And of course the problem is you can only carry so much of it with you.
Right.
So it's going to be a ways before we have an alternative energy for a jet. But that doesn't mean there aren't applications where where batteries go. My personal opinion is, at least with the current state of the art, is that we're going to be, where batteries work, they're a good thing. You know, I think there's we built and some others have built battery-operated Greensboros. I think they're a good solution. You know, the hybrids, what we were talking about a few minutes ago, hybrids mm-hmm. make sense for a couple of reasons. One is the improved efficiency. The other place where hybrids really make a lot of sense is where you have a big difference between the peak power and the average power.
Hmm.
And
I'm assuming when you're mowing, and average power maybe when you're just transporting.
Yeah, actually, it turns out that if you look at our hybrid fairway mowers, mm-hmm. the peak powers are when you're climbing hills.
Ah.
It's not so much when you're mowing.
Because you're carrying the weight up the hill.
You're carrying the weight up the hill. And that actually costs you a lot of power to get up the hill. And so what we find that we do is the mowing is pretty constant, at least in a fairway. So mm-hmm. what we'll do is we mow with the electrics, and when we get those peaks, climbing hills tend to be fairly short. And because you're just the hill is fairly short. So what we'll do there is we run the engine at a low power setting, mm-hmm. and we're providing power to the cutting units. And when we need a bit more power for climbing the hill, we actually turn the generator off that's taking power off the engine so the engine can provide the power to climb the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually power the cutting units with the batteries.
Whoa.
And so we can get by with a smaller engine that burns less fuel, but yet give you the same kind of performance that you had before.
Boy, and you did without even knowing it, Dana, you did a perfect way for us to a segue to the next topic that I want to talk to you when we come back again, our final message from our sponsor, Dana, because that the mower knows to switch to use the motor for the driving up the hill and the batteries for the reels. That switch has got to be some sensing technology built in that
yep.
mower, yes?
Yes. Well,
it senses the load
and smart machine.
Converts the energy, a smart machine.
Yep.
And so listen, when we come back after this message, we're going to get right into the sensing technology and potential automations coming out of the Center for Advanced Turf Technology. I'm being joined today, I'm frankly speaking, with Dana Lawn from the Toro Company. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour.
Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi here on the TurfNet Radio Network, joined today by Dana Lawn, the Managing Director, Center for Advanced Turf Technology at the Toro Company. And when we left our conversation, we had just been sort of wandering our way through energy demands. I certainly always learn when I'm having a conversation with Dana about how advanced some of these things that people just call a lawnmower, how advanced and sophisticated, in fact, as smart as they can be. And what I'd like to do now, Dana, is transition our conversation to trying to create, intelligence around the golf course, whether it's sensing technology and monitoring soil moisture and using that as a tool for irrigation, or it's automation, maybe with large-scale use of robotics on the larger areas of the property. Before we get into, ex machina, we talk about robotics, I do want to talk about sensing technology and really ask you a very specific question. One of the things that I was really impressed when I saw your presentation was your discussion of the difference between using evapotranspiration versus using these soil moisture sensors. I thought that was really telling. Can you take a minute, if you recall what I'm talking about, and say, because sure, we've been using evapotranspiration, and you went so far as to say, I'd rather have soil sensors than a weather station. So can you talk for a little bit first,
sure,
about the sort of a tool we've always used with maybe an emerging tool now in soil sensing?
Well, I think the best way to talk about this, Frank, is to think of it as the example I always used to like to use is deciding how do you to me, watering the turf, because what do we do when we water the turf? What we're doing is putting moisture in the soil so that the plant can extract the moisture, right? So mm-hmm. we're placing water in the soil. And what is the soil act as? The soil acts as it's a reservoir. It's a tank, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the analogy for that? To me, the analogy for that is the tank of fuel that your car has. So now let's think about that. How do we decide when we're going to put fuel in our car? To me, ET is equivalent of the way you would decide if you're using ET to figure the fuel in your car. Most new cars you can program on your dash that'll tell you how fast it was using the gas up, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's how much, what's your instantaneous miles per gallon?
Mm-hmm.
You could look at that and say, okay, based on how many miles per gallon I got, I could say, well, I'm getting 20 miles a gallon. I drove 2 miles today, or I drove 40 miles today, so I used 2 gallons of gas, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what
yep.
ET does. It says that
okay.
we use 2 gallons. And then what does ET tell you to do? Go to the gas station, buy 2 gallons of gas, and replace it, because that's what you lost yesterday.
Yeah, or some percentage of that, right? 60%, 80%.
Yeah, but it's based on what you lost. So the
right.
mentality there is, how do I keep this tank full all the time? I don't want to overfill it, but I want to keep it full all the time. Now let's flip ourselves over to how do you decide. That isn't how you decide how much gas to put in your car. What you do to decide how much gas you put in your car, I would argue you use two pieces of information. The first piece of information is the fuel gauge. Right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Gauge,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the fuel gauge has two critical locations on it.
That's right. E and F.
It's got E and F. Okay, what's F when it comes to the soil?
Saturated. or well watered.
Field capacity.
Field capacity.
Really field capacity, right?
Okay. Yep, that's right.
Because if you put more water on there than at field capacity, what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's now you're limiting oxygen. Yeah, yeah.
It's going to run off. It's equivalent of your tank full and you put gas in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's of no value to you, right?
Yep.
What's the other critical place from the soil's perspective?
Wilting point. I guess E would be wilting point.
It's wilting point, right. So what's your objective as an irrigator? I want to keep it between F and E. Just exactly like when you take gas in your car, you don't want to get it below E. So then what's your other critical, what's the other data point that you use in filling your gas?
How far you're going to drive that day?
How far you're going to drive that day, or how convenient is it for me to get more fuel? And what's the equivalent of how far is it going to drive that day when it comes to irrigation?
That would be ET then.
No, it is, but I would argue it's a subset of it's a more generalized version of ET. It's what's the weather going to be like?
Okay.
Because it's not only because ET has only the concept of use, but the other critical factor with weather is how much is it going to rain?
Mm-hmm.
Because where do you want soil moisture when it's going to rain?
You want soil moisture low.
You want soil moisture as low as it could be. So what?
Right.
What? So I would argue your whole irrigation mentality is not the mentality of ET, which is replace what I've lost. Because now you have the soil full, and when it's going to rain, there's no place for the water to go. What really should our mentality move to in a water-conserving environment? Our mentality should move to, I want to plan for rainfall, and I want to keep the soil as dry as I can keep it. I want to keep it as close to empty as I can. Because now there's a place for the water.
Right, and more so, I would argue as well that by keeping it on the dry side, you're allowing the roots to do maybe some exploration of the soil that they might not otherwise do if it's always at field capacity. They'll just sit fat and happy, maybe get a little bit lazy. You could argue that as soon as they do dry, they're not going to be stress tolerant at all. So there's a number of sort of biological, physiological arguments that support what you're saying. There also is the downside to this, as you know, Dana, you know, learning where and how far you can dry it out. That's where still I think we're at an artistry phase with turf, because a little too dry and you can get the development of localized dry spots in very sandy environments. So learning that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I agree with what you said. The other factor I would add to what you just said, and I'll come back to this, is the other thing is it's probably less disease prone. There's a lot of diseases that the wetter it is, the worse it is.
Exactly right. There's no question There's no question about the fact. A drier, especially in golf, but you could argue in every form of turf management, drier is always better than – there are fewer problems when you're dry than when you're too wet.
Right. Now, so let's talk a bit about your learning. And I agree with that. You need to learn where it is, or learn where the critical zones are. Once you get a soil moisture sensor in, and you need to get them in places where you really have to move your mindset from where are the exceptions to where are good typical indicator spots. I also think then you need to go through, you need to kind of monitor things and watch it. It's more than just probing, and I'm totally in support of the handheld probes to measure soil moisture, but I also think it's really critical that you have buried soil moisture sensors, because the temporal, the time history is really important. You need to watch how the dry down cycles happen.
Yeah.
And you need to learn where those critical empty points are, And it actually turns out, if you watch, the amount that it goes down in any one day is really an indicator of ET.
Sure it is.
That really is, that's really ET.
That's
so,
exactly right.
So you need to be planning ahead based on, okay, here's where, and so to me, where we're going to use ET in the future is not for what has happened, but what's going to happen. We're going to load ET into with weather models to say, okay, here's the forecasted ET, so I need to have a quarter tank of gas to plan for the weather that's going to happen, because I know it's going to rain in 2 days, so that I need to apply water because I know I need a quarter tank now, so that
so,
I don't get too dry.
That's right.
So you can plan around. So instead of guessing, you can plan around because you know how close you are to being empty.
Now, one of the things that I like to bring up when I talk about these sensing topics is the study that was done by these ag engineers at the University of Florida. And they did this work, Dana, with home lawns in South Florida. And they put in a few different
– David Dukes. I'm sure it's David Dukes is the faculty. Smart guy.
That smart guy. And you know, I'm sure you, of course, know the results of this. And it's leading to my question here, where in one way, I would argue watering is – irrigating a turf area is still that sort of art that we have. I just don't feel like guys have enough data. Now they're getting more data. ET was the first piece. Then they went to the handheld things. Now we've got the in-ground wireless sensors. So – that part's coming up. And these guys said, let's put the soil moistures in charge of the irrigation system, and let's compare that to commercial people or homeowners watering their lawn when they think it needs it. And I'm sure you know the study that I'm talking about. In general, what they concluded was that just letting the sensors irrigate these lawns was improving water efficiency 40 to 60%. With that in mind, do you imagine we will get to a place where we'll have these smart irrigation systems on sports fields and golf courses?
No doubt in my mind.
No doubt in my mind.
I have a soil moisture sensor in my yard at home, which I've had for 3 or 4 years. And I honestly don't pay attention to my irrigation. I turn it on because I know it won't run again until it's dry enough. And you know, it's
that simple.
It's in my opinion, it's that simple. Now I might be, you know, I don't mean to take all the art out of it, because there is a bit of experience, but I really come back to the there is home lawns is the home lawns is the there's just tremendous to be saved there, because so many homeowners, you know, I can tell you my own personal experience with mine. About 3 or 4 years ago, I divided my yard in half. I had half of the yard.
Of course you did. Of course you did. What else would the director of the turf technology do but split up his yard?
I divided it in half. Half of it I ran 20 minutes every other day, you know, like a normal person would run.
Okay.
I had half of it on a moisture sensor. And over a two-month period, now I will admit we had one of those two-month periods. I live in Minneapolis. We had one of those two-month periods. It was the middle of the summer where we had really timely rainfalls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they happened when they needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Over a two-month period, my half of the yard that was running 20 minutes every other day ran 200. The irrigation ran 250 minutes over 2 months.
Yeah.
The half that was controlled by the moisture sensor ran 39 minutes.
So,
and I could not tell the difference in the grass.
That's right. And that's the thing, too. And I think one of the challenges that we face is as we start to use some of the intelligence that the sensing technology is going to give us, I think your point, and I don't want our listeners to miss it. I think one of the keys to using these sensors right is having good indicator areas and also being able to define what those subjective measures are. How firm does the fairway have to be for it to roll as far as it can? I think I heard you say this, and I'm a little bit with you. You know, do we want to fuss about this on our putting greens where they're small areas? I thought I heard you argue really the place for these sensors is in the larger areas where a lot more water is used, and developing the right subjective targets from our golfers or from our athletes about what those surfaces need to be like, then you can really capitalize on the intelligence in this technology. Isn't that right, Dana?
Absolutely true. You know, you look at a golf course, you got just rules of thumb, maybe 3 or 4 acres of greens.
Yeah.
You got 30 acres of fairways.
Yeah. So yeah. And they're irrigated.
There's 10 times water savings. 10 times the water savings.
So you like to see these things in the soils, in the native soils.
I think they should be in the native soils. I think you should find good irrigation, get good indicator areas in the native soils, and that's what was my comment in the thing. I'd rather have one of those sensors in a place that you would consider to be, I'll say, typical. Think about a weather station. You don't have hundreds of weather stations. You've got one that you've put in a place that you consider typical.
You hope.
You consider it to be a good indicator of what the weather is like at your site. And we want to do the same thing here. You don't want to put it in an odd spot, a wet spot, a dry spot. You just don't. You got to find a typical. Now, it's obviously better if you can have two. Two are better than one. Three are better than two. You know, so to have a few is a good thing. But, you know, it doesn't, you know, if you come back to why have we not put moisture sensors in? It was always like, well, there's so much variability that we need a billion of them. Well, I'm not convinced that's true either.
I would go typical. That's right. I would go one step further, and my good pal, Professor Doug Soldat at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I make fun of him endlessly because he's always encouraging people to use the Webb Soil Survey so people could map out their soils. And this is a really good example of being very intentional about the use of technology. Mapping your soils, which you can do in about an hour with the Webb Soil Survey, and then determining how many soil types you're trying to manage with water, and then deploy the sensing technology to then give you the information about the way you'd install the sensors. And really, then it just becomes a matter of sort of depth and topography to ultimately determine sort of how you're going to use this technology. But I think it's a very active process to get it set up to use it, right, Dana? And then it's tweaking it in the long run, I think, that we've got to get started on.
Yep, exactly. I got one little bit of trivia, too. Doug Soldat's father and I went to the same high school as each other. He's a year older than I am.
Is that right? That is so great. And so listen, with that personal note, I will thank you for taking 50 minutes of your time to spend with us here on the radio program, Dana. What a great joy. And my great joy about this is we didn't get to all my topics in hopes that I can have you back. Will you join us again?
I absolutely will, Frank.
Great. Thanks, Dana. Appreciate Dana Lon, professional engineer, managing director, Center for Advanced Turf Technology at the Toro Company. My name's Frank Rossi. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers in the turf grass industry. Hear from you on another episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.